with them to make me her daughter. Not biological, but she called me a struggle daughter. So, and I was very honored to be the only person to have that title. She had lots of sons, but I was the only one that you called her daughter. Besides a biological daughter, of course. So that was a great honor for me. Oh, I met her when I was about 17 years old, shortly after, I had to consult her in Durban around a legal issue. And, so I met her in our office in Durban, and then the legal issue was resolved, and then I met her again in exile in Zimbabwe. After she had come from Lesotho, she had to leave Lesotho quite after a bomb. And she was working at the University of Zimbabwe. And that's when I met her again.
So, did you grow up in the apartheid era?
Yes, absolutely. My parents were activists. I grew up in a township near Cape Town. We were brought up, my parents were very keen that we needed to understand what life was about in South Africa. So the struggle was daily discussion around the table, the dinner table. We were very conscious of what we could and couldn't do. My parents tried to ensure that we, even though we were confined to a township of one race group, they made sure that we were exposed in other social settings to people of all race groups in South Africa. So, the school we went to, the government was a government school, but initially, all race groups were at that school. Later on, apartheid laws became more strict, and we were confined to a single race group at the school. But we were taken to... My parents were arrested in the Defiance campaign, and we were taken to protect all kinds of things throughout our childhood.
So, was it dangerous to be an activist?
Dangerous. We were about, I was about 15, 16 years old. There was a student protest at the University of Cape, at the University of the Western Cape. And we, of course, went with my father to all the protest meetings. At one of the meetings, we discovered that many of the students didn't have anywhere to go. So my father invited them to stay with us. I don't know how we managed, but we had bodies all over the house. We were in a tiny three-bedroom township house. And then the students came and joined us. Some of them boys in my brother's room, so they had bunk beds all over and mattresses on the floor, and so it was several months that the students stayed with us because they had nowhere else to go. So about it being dangerous, so we were constantly being watched by the police. They knew details of our family that they revealed at various stages. My brother and sister, younger brother and sister, were picked up, I think just harassment. Our friends were regularly picked up. At one point, we were driving in a combi, and of course, a panel van, and of course, we were a mixed group of young people. The police picked out the one African person who was with us, and they beat him rather badly, and made remarks about what are you good girls doing with these people, sort of those kind of remarks. So the threat of being hurt and being harassed by the police was always there.
So Phyllis was a rather fierce warrior woman, wasn't she?
Absolutely, you've got the correct description there. Type of woman who, she was a fierce warrior woman and yet so soft. Wonderful. When there was injustice, she was fierce and ready to fight anyone, ready to take on anything.
Yeah.
And faced by little things of my daughter, for instance, was she considered a granddaughter, and she was so soft and gentle with her. She was motherly, and when I was going through my divorce, she was my main support and looked after me so tenderly. She's fierce, but also the kindest person you could ever see. She knew everybody in the area where she lived, so every day her daily walk was from her flat to a local shopping center where she had lunch, breakfast mainly. And all along the way she would meet people, and they would talk to her about their problems, and Phyllis, she gave legal advice, advised people to go to a doctor, advised all kinds of advice. Women who had issues with trying to get maintenance for their children, she gave them advice about how to go about that. And so it took about an hour to walk to the shopping center that we normally take about 10-15 minutes. And because she spoke to so many people. And then while we would have breakfast at the cafe, she would be acting with everybody who came by. They all knew her, and she talked to everybody. And she would laugh about some things with people, or ask questions about how are your children, your grandchildren. What happened about your sister? And she had this incredible memory. She remembered what the issues were of the various people she met. And then, of course, I had to hear about, that one is such an amazing life, and hear the story of that person's life too.
It's so good to have this opportunity to honour her. And also Irene and everybody else who worked against apartheid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Irene, I met when Phyllis said to me, Gonda, a friend of mine is coming from Australia. And I didn't ask any questions. She was coming to Cape Town. And so I said, sure, Phil, we should come. She can come and stay with me. And then Irene and Linda came and stayed with me in my house in Cape Town. They were just here for a few days, but we clicked immediately, had a great rapport between us, and it was such a huge honor to meet her.
Yeah.
Because of course I'd heard about her from Phyllis and all her involvement in the anti-apartheid struggle and so forth, yeah.
So you were with Phyllis one time after there was a bombing.
Yeah, I was with that was 1990. We had people coming from South Africa for a conference. I think it was an economics conference. We were involved in trying, they were talking about the future of South Africa, etc. And after the conference, we were, I think, in Maxwell's room in the hotel when we heard this loud explosion. And somebody said, oh dear, that doesn't sound good. Wonder what happened. And then a few minutes later, we got this call to say my flat had been bombed. And I immediately thought of Aunt Phil, Phyllis Nigel, because she was supposed to, I knew that they were meeting with Mike that day. They were going to have a farewell for him because he was going off to another parish in another town. And Phyllis had been with him, I think, for most of that day. So I was afraid that she was involved in this explosion. So my first reaction was to go drive to her house. And as I arrived at the house, I could see the house was in darkness. The car pulled up behind me, and there was Phyllis in that car. And I said to her, have you heard Mike received a parcel bomb? And she said, oh, well, we just left him about an hour ago, when she was with Terry Kanekom at the time, and Terry Kentrish. And I said, she said, where is he? And I said, he's been taken to Avenue Clinic. So she said, let's go. We got into my car and Avenue Clinic was a few minutes away. We drove there, and sure enough, there was Phyllis was taken in to see Mike. And I was allowed to go in, but I stood back because I knew the relationship between Phyllis and Mike. And I heard Mike say to Phyllis, please pray for me. And there Phyllis was trying to say the Our Father for Mike because he knew no other prayer. Please ask him, Phyllis, atheist, to pray for you. You know I have a prayer. And then she couldn't remember the words of the Our Father. Yeah. But anyway, while I was in there, Avenue's clinic was a private hospital. And I heard the doctor saying that they can't keep them there because they were worried that the South Africans would come and bomb them or try to kill Mike in their clinic. And so they were saying he has to be moved. At that time, I was on call at Parinenato Hospital, and I knew all the doctors at Parinenato dentists. So I knew all the doctors at Parinenato Hospital, so I quickly said to Phil, I'm going to try and get Mike into Parirenyako Hospital. So I drove over there, and then the ambulance came with Mike, and I was able to prepare and call the orthopedic surgeon and call different people who came and talk to Mike at Parirenyako Hospital. Yeah, it was really awful. I can't imagine how he survived that time. His injuries were so terrible. He was, when they brought him in, his whole body was black. The clothes he wore, everything, his face. You couldn't see any pink skin through anything. It was awful. It really looked awful. And then they started cutting away. I was in the emergency room when they started cutting away clothes. And then I left the emergency room at that point because he was in good hands. And yeah, it was awful. I don't know how we survived it. I get a lot thinking about it, and yeah, it's probably traumatic. Yeah.
Were parcel bombs common?
You see, it was at a time when they just kind of had the unbanning of the ANC. There was a lot of euphoria around about how things were going to change and how we were going to go back home and things were going to be better. And then out of the blue, this parcel bomb.
Mm.
So we speculated that, they were out to get Mike. We don't know how long that bomb lay at his house before he opened it, you know, and it could have hurt any number of people. It was a horrible time, sorry. It was, parcel bombs were common, if you remember, Abraham Tiro, in the early 70s, I think around about 74, he was killed by parcel bomb in Botswana. There were, over the years, there were parcel bombs that killed a number of people. Justice Albie Sachs was bombed in Mozambique, in Maputo. I was in Lusaka when I'm walking towards the post office once, when one of the comrades responsible for picking up the mail opened the parcel and also got bombed, locked his hand in that bombing. Ruth First, of course, is also a parcel bomb. So, parcel bombs were a common form of apartheid state trying to get rid of their opponents.
Are children in South Africa taught that history now?
My daughter was at school more than 10 years ago. So when she was at school, she had a really good history teacher. And they were taught that history. And in fact, that teacher of hers got me to come and speak to the whole school about my story. So that this children could be exposed. And unfortunately, a lot of the what should be taught about that particular history is not well captured in the syllabus that children are taught at school.
Can you tell us what it felt like when Nelson Mandela got out of jail?
Yeah, well, that was the period that I remember. So I need to take you back, sort of, to the 2nd of February, 1990, when the announcement was made by F.W. de Klerk that the ANC would be unbanned. So I was alone at home. Because I was ill that day, so I was actually in bed listening to the BBC. And suddenly this announcement comes, the ANC and all political parties will be unbanned. And I was living in this house with people who didn't know that, there were people working in the house who didn't know that I was from South Africa or a member of the ANC. So I went into the bathroom and I danced and I screamed silently because I couldn't. I was so happy. It was like the best news. I was going home. I was going, and the first person I put up, I was called on Phil. But I couldn't phone her at that moment because the people would have heard. Yeah, remember it was landlines and anyway. So soon as people heard the house, I picked up the phone and I said, "Uncle, did you hear?" And we were, talking and we're laughing and we're going home, and it was the best news ever. And then a few days later, Nelson Mandela was released, and he was coming to Harare. And we prepared for that that visit. We made posters. We were all excited. And of course, Phyllis was a friend of Nelson Mandela, so she was hoping to be able to see him time. So it was, wonderful, wonderful day. And Madiba came to Harare. We were all standing there with our posters, welcome Madiba to Harare.
That's so beautiful.
And then we heard, so it was fabulous time. We all went back to Phyllis's house after that, and we were celebrating. There was a party, and she, of course, cooked for all of us. No matter when you visited Phyllis, the first thing she did was go to the kitchen and cook and feed you. So we had to eat, and it was absolutely stunning day.
A terrible time that you lived through, but the emotion of that, I can hear it, I can feel it just through talking to you. It's so wonderful.
It was, I think that 1990 was a roller coaster of, feeling euphoric and then down in the dumps with Mike's bombing, and then we started, Phyllis was asked to go to, I think it was to Sweden. And then she was going to go home back to South Africa. So it was all kinds of things happening, and you gain on this emotional roller coaster, and then also fear, on the 15th of June 1990, because I had an Indian passport. I was married at the time to a guy of Indian descent, and so we were eligible to receive Indian passports. I had an Indian passport. So the instruction came to me to try and apply for a visa to go to South Africa and to kind of go back home. So my visa came through, and my trip immediately was booked, and I was on the 15th of June 1990 on a flight to Johannesburg. I had very, very fearful when I landed at the airport, Jan Smuts Airport, then the immigration came and they stamped my passport, and then there was a closed door behind the immigration official, and this man said to me, "Go through those doors." And I hadn't seen anybody else go through those doors. They were all using the bigger doors on the other side. And I thought, here it goes. I'm going to be arrested as soon as I go through those doors. But when I went through the doors, there the arrivals swarm and my baggage going round and round on the luggage thing. And so I quickly picked up my luggage. I was one of the last people going through, and picked up my luggage and almost ran out of there. And I went through customs, hoping, please don't stop me, please don't stop me. I'm so scared at this stage. There were automatic doors right at the end of the corridor of the customs, and it opens, and the first face I see is my dad. My dad waiting for me there with a huge group of people, because they were afraid that I would be arrested, so they gathered lots of people to come to the airport so that if I were arrested, they could immediately stage a protest.
Oh, gosh.
So there was this group of people, and all shouting, "Gonda, Gonda, Gonda!" 1990 was a roller coaster of emotions. Unbelievable emotions.
Can I take a photo of you from this now with those beautiful pictures of yours behind you?
Those are a friend of mine gave them. They are the, what do you call them, orchids from Cuba.
Ah.
So, yeah.
From Cuba?
So they are, yeah, so they are prints. We were in Cuba. And there was an exhibition of the most beautiful photographs of orchids.
Oh, that's lovely.
And, yeah, so Fred Pine bought a set of these prints for me, and I had them framed, so, yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful. Is that okay if I take a photo?
My Cuban... Yeah, sure, that's fine. Can you...
Ah, that's good.
Did it come out all right?
Yeah. Yeah, it did. Yeah. It's lovely, actually. You've got a big smile. It's absolutely precious talking to you. Thank you so much.